This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 524. On today's show, I talk to Yo Joanne, who was the 2022 spring resident of the CareRec Project of Orlando. Last weekend, Joanne had her reading at the end of her residency, and the video for that is already up over at the Drunken Odyssey's YouTube channel. If you're a fan of this show and do find yourself on YouTube from time to time, please subscribe to the Drunken Odyssey's YouTube channel. I'm planning on increasing the amount of video content on there and not just readings. More information on that will be coming out soonishly. Joanne's novel, Impractical Uses of Cake, has as its protagonist a rather youngish curmudgeon, a character I very much identify with despite, you know, my general age and state of decrepitude. I wouldn't be totally surprised if it was possible to see myself, prelingual, in the womb, that I would be wordlessly thinking, this is bogus, which might explain why I made an early exit from the womb. What was I talking about? If you'd like to write in to the Drunken Odyssey, the address is thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. Original, I know. All right, let's get to the interview.
And now, the interview of the day.
I am back in the CareRec house with Yo Joanne, who is our spring resident, and she's the author of Impractical Uses of Cake, and the plot blurb is actually so good, I'm going to read it. Normally, I throw that out and come up with my own, but okay. Socially awkward, misanthropic English literature teacher, Sukin's well-ordered life is thrown off track by a chance encounter with a woman from his past. She's homeless, and she's happy, and he can't believe it. As he digs deeper, chaos ensues, fueled by cake and tea and heaps of cardboard. Thank you so much for joining me for a talk here.
Oh, thank you, John, for asking me. Lovely to be here.
So, I'm not exactly sure of all the reasons, but I am so in love with your protagonist, who is just calmly miserable. throughout this entire book. He's kind of grumpy, and everything that everybody does bothers him, with the exception of his ex-girlfriend. Although, even then, she kind of bothers. But he's, this is how he experiences love, is he tolerates. Like, not even behaviorally towards her, but internally, like, he's regulating himself to accept the things that she does that annoy him, even when he clearly wants her fully back in his life, even if that's probably, like, there's clearly a much bigger mystery at the core of this story and at her story.
I guess it's a man completely obsessed with logic. So, I mean, that some of us, right, are okay with logic, right? You know, you want things to be reasonable, to be logical, to be structured in some way, right? But Sukin's nuts. He needs to rationalize pretty much everything, like everything that everyone else is doing. Why he's doing everything that he's doing is something that he's always constantly thinking about. So yes, you're right, absolutely. That, like, tolerance, but even then, the tolerance comes with, like, okay, trying to understand and put it into his own terms before he actually, well, tolerates in that sense.
But everything that everybody does bothers him, and everything that everybody does bothers me in this story, so that I don't know if you just wrote, like, I don't know if I'm your perfect audience for this novel, or if you're tapping into something, because, yeah, part of his problem is he notices everything and he pays attention to everything, which means he has to process everything, which is exhausting. And yeah, it's like, okay, going to work and dealing with the irrationality, the profound irrationality of a student is just horrible for him. And then when the other teachers are irrational, and then of course the principal is irrational, it's like there's just no escape.
But that's, I feel like, everyone's lives in a way. I don't know. I feel that a lot of things we find after a while are perfectly logical, perfectly right, right? And they sit right with us. But at the same time, if, like, an outsider actually took a look at things, right, and saw exactly what we did with our lives every day, the people we interacted with, I think a lot of us would look just nuts. Actually.
What are you doing?
Because we've already rationalized so many things, right? Like the time you wake up, all your various idiosyncrasies, the idiosyncrasies, the people you like, the people you dislike, right? All of these things on a daily basis, we're always doing this to ourselves, right? Without perhaps the level of thought that Sukin puts into his, you know, rationalizations, right? But we do it. And I think that's why sometimes you meet a complete stranger, right? And then you tell them certain things about yourself, and you realize that there's so much stuff that you have to not say in order to not come across as nuts. Happens to me a lot. Happens to me a lot.
Or maybe it's just writers.
Maybe.
Which is how we become writers.
Yeah. Like, there's too much crazy in you that you have to sit for hours at a laptop and a document and put your crazy out there so that it's outside of you now, and then there's new crazy that can now develop. Maybe?
Well, now I want to go back and reread the otter sections of this book, because, like, does your protagonist here react to otter behavior the way that he reacts to human behavior? Because the human behavior almost always, occasionally it moves him. Although even when it moves him, he's like, yeah, that guy's crazy.
Yeah, pretty much. But he's a lot more forgiving of the otters, more accepting of the otters being otters, right? All the otters do cute, lovely things in his eyes, right? But the humans,
even when they're killing fish.
Exactly.
Eating their heads off and just drop. It's like, look at that. And it's like, yeah, we're not fish. So it's isn't that adorable?
That's true. But authors are. Author watching is quite an obsession in Singapore. It is, yeah, people, there are forums, Facebook groups, a whole bunch of people just tracking down authors. And if an author, is it pup, cub, pup, I think, an author child, okay? An author child goes missing. It is like, it's such a big deal. And people,
no, because, like, otters are already too cute, and it's like, okay, here's a baby otter. And it's like,
Hyper cute, right?
It's hard to be grumpy when you're looking at a baby otter.
So people spend days actually thinking about like where the author is, tracking it down, that search parties are sent out, you know, that kind of thing. It's, yeah, it is the Singapore.
And so Ken clearly notes, though, like, and it's eating a fish, like it's killing a fish right now.
Which is a good thing for the author. Not good for the fish, but who cares?
Yeah.
This is what I get out of it, is like he's noting, okay, yeah, it's murdering another creature that has an equal right to be alive, but who am I to judge this imbalance in nature? Or maybe this is the ugly balance of nature, but I'm okay with it, even though, you know, if this was a person, it wouldn't stop at, well, who am I to judge nature? It's like, people are not natural. So there's no point in stopping the judging of people.
Yeah, because he finds that everyone isn't natural, isn't behaving the way they should. But authors are different, right? So authors behave exactly like they should. If an author began, I don't know, raiding bakeries and eating cake, I think Sukin would have a problem with that, right? He'd be in defense of cake now. But if the author...
Or pudding, yeah.
If the author stuck to fish, which it should... It was behaving exactly. It is behaving exactly how authors should behave. Yeah. So a lot about should and shouldn't in Suking as well, right? People should be doing this. I should be doing this. I shouldn't be doing that, right? And that's why it's a bit odd.
Well, but also everyone has their own definition of like what people should be doing, and they make the mistake of telling other people, or they make the mistake of telling Sukin here that, like, you should be doing this. And it's like, oh, I don't. All right, time to go. Great to see you, Mom. It's
yeah. What else about, I mean, you know, Sukin appealed to you specifically?
Well, partly it's the way you crafted the story and created the characters, because he's got a friend against his will who's gay and flirty. And it just seems like this very comfortable, high conflict friendship. That if this were a sitcom, like, this is the perfect dark yet funny and somehow deeply human story that I would love to get out of most sitcoms. You know, like the best ones that kind of feel like, yeah, when Sukin and Dennis are in the same room. Like, that's kind of what it feels like, because they're just such alien creatures to each other. And I think Dennis realizes that and doesn't care. Mm. And so I think that our hero here half the time wonders if Dennis is being an asshole on purpose or if he can't help it.
I don't know. I think more of a love story to me, you know, somehow, right? Dennis and Sukin in a lot of ways, because they're forced to work with each other, right? There is that, like, that contact you can't actually not have, right? There's this person flinging himself in your face on a, like, daily basis, right? And Sukin deals with it. And it is out of love. He doesn't say it. He never does, right? But it has to be out of love. Nobody tolerates that kind of, right, flinging yourself in someone else's face if it isn't love. And that love without understanding. So that's quite, I think, quite interesting and quite, you know. Yeah.
Well, but one relief from Dennis is he really doesn't need to talk about it. Yeah. And so it's like all or almost all subtext, except for the flirting, which, again... is part of the joy of it, because it's like if he pushes it too far, then it's not a joke. Mm. And it's this weird thing where it's like, no, we're going to be comfortably intimate, and I don't care if people think we're a couple. And at one point people do think
it a couple. And there was one, I think at one point in time when I was writing it, I thought, should I pursue that as like a part of the novel? Like, take that into, like, something about Sukin and Dennis being seen together somewhere, and then a rumor starts and that kind of thing, and he gets in trouble in school.
Sukin gets gossip about him in several ways because of the strange things he ends up doing. I think in the case of Dennis, and this may be a case of, I don't know, you know, I think when we met at the potluck welcome dinner, you know, and I told you I got the book, and you go, oh, you know, do you find it difficult as an American to read it? The novel's in English, and it's in beautiful English, but you were wondering if it was, like, culturally off-putting or if it was difficult to find my balance, and it's like, nope, there's one linguistic thing that I notice is specific to the text, the way that people talk. Didn't make it any more difficult, but I noticed, okay, that's slightly different, but if this were set in Orlando, I would accept it. Like, it would make total sense to me. And in American culture, you know, there's this thing called queer theory, which is all the ways that men behave because they're terrified people will think that they're gay.
Okay.
And one of the consequences of that is men's friendships are supposed to be very limited. Oh, we watch sports, and we can cry together if we're watching sports, but I'm not supposed to otherwise, like...
No soul bearing, that kind of thing, yeah.
The whole, the thing that you said, like, theirs is a love story, like, that would be seen as threatening.
That would be gay.
it would be gay, or close enough to being gay to be an emergency that everyone then had to sort out, and normally what that means is just lots of ugly behavior. Mm. And I think, like, the smarter people of my generation would lean into that. And it's like, well, so what if it's gay? Or if it's a little gay, who, like, why should I destroy friendship? Or, like, I'm not afraid to go there. I'm, like, 99.5% straight. Like, that's, I wish I were gayer. Because I've actually thought about it, I'm not scared. And so with gay friends, it's not like, oh, you know, well, I have to, got to make sure the categories are all right, because otherwise, if someone thinks, like, I'm like,
yeah,
I'm old, I'm grumpy, I don't care what people think. I'm not worried, like, ooh, like, what is his sexuality? I'm like, I like having friends. Yeah. Like, friendship is way more important than anyone defining my sexuality. It's like, if you haven't been invited in my bedroom, like, just shut up.
I think the thing with Singapore is that it's a little complicated, right? Because you can't be out if you're a teacher in Singapore. So it's a little political that way, right?
And so Dennis is either walking right up to that line or walking past that line, but trying to be
just not saying
crafty about it.
Just not saying it, right?
Yeah. Well, he's not, he's not declaring himself as out.
Exactly.
But his behavior is who can kind of...
Yeah, and at no point does he... I mean, we don't... He doesn't talk about his partners at work. You know, he treads that line. And a lot of teachers find they have to in Singapore for one reason or other, right? So I have quite a few friends who are teachers, and some of them are gay, right? And that's something that in Singapore, you're not really allowed to do. You don't, you're not allowed to be out and a teacher, because the idea is that somehow, right, you're encouraging, I don't know, younger people to be gay? I don't know, right? I'm not sure if that is a thing.
Because the people who write the laws are like the people who don't want to talk about it or think about it or deal with it or process it.
Yeah. They find that perhaps they're, you know, 90% straight, but they don't know the 10% is going to, you know, move a bit over time. I'm not sure. But they are clearly threatened, I feel.
Well, I think my love of Sukin, a lot of it comes from just his friendship with Dennis. And even though he's grumpy about it, if he were grumpier, he could just stop it. Like, it's not impossible to stop it. It's part of him doesn't want to. Like, part of him wants Dennis to be, I don't know, have better boundaries. But apart from that, I don't think he wants Dennis to not be his friend.
Yeah. Hey, he doesn't set those boundaries either. He doesn't say, don't come over to my house, right? Don't come over to my place. Don't come unannounced. Let me know. He doesn't do any of these
things. Don't buy me a couch that looks like an ostrich.
So he doesn't. For all his, I don't know, he's a stickler for so many rules and, you know, things that have to be like this and have to be like that. But he actually doesn't set many rules for his, the people that he loves.
Right? Which is not a long list.
No, it's not a long list.
Kind of, sort of, his parents.
Kind of, sort
of. Kind of, sort of, like, just technically more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although there is this sort of homeless food kitchen volunteer group who, even if he is kind of judgmental some of the time, it seems like he does find a lot of purpose there. And it's like, oh, you know, there are things you could do that are actually going to help people and actually going to make people happy. And you could just see it. Like, hungry people are now fed, mm-hmm. not just fed, but fed with dignity. And people are creating not just adequate meals, but like working hard to create real meals out of discarded food. And, you know, like that subplot, you know, and it's hard to tell exactly what Sokin's getting out of it other than the joy of, okay, I could do this thing and I'm not going to get a whole lot of crap from people, and students aren't going to go, okay, I haven't done any homework and I'm failing, but I don't want to fail. Is there anything I could do? It's, you know, the utility of just directly doing something good. And partly it's there to impress his ex-girlfriend, Jin.
Yeah. He doesn't, these things just happen to him. So he just ends up doing stuff because she does stuff, right? He doesn't go out there and like do anything on his own. Very few decisions are actually made by him, aside from decisions to tolerate or to not tell people that there are boundaries or whatever, right? Most of the time, it's just getting, carried along with whatever someone else ends up wanting him to do. So it happens a lot with, Dennis. It happens a lot with Dennis, right? It happens a lot with Jin. Like, whatever she does, he thinks, okay, you know, if I'm going to have to share her time with, like, people, and it happens to be this soup kitchen sort of setup, then I guess I'll have to do it.
And he can't find a way to crap on it, or...
So he just ends up having life in a weird sort of way happen to him, right? And that's what makes him so miserable, right? The lack of, I don't know, what do we say? It's like you don't take any decisions for yourself, right? So you can't take any credit for anything that goes right in your life, right? And therefore, everything is just stuff that happens to you, some things that are out of your control.
Well, some of the things he does turn out right.
Yes.
But I don't think he wants the acknowledgement of that. He just wants to see good come out of it.
And he can't define that either. It's really difficult for him. You know, just defining like what he wants, what good is, what for him would be a good life. And I think that's for me, I think a lot of the stuff that I was struggling with when I wrote this. So just trying to understand like what it meant to be good, to do well.
In a materialist world.
Mm. Yeah.
I think that's what a lot of this is about, is disassociation and what am I supposed to be doing? And people are telling me what I'm supposed to be doing, which seems to be an escalation of what I'm doing now, which brings me no pleasure at all. And the capacity for joy just seems impossible. Mm. So I don't know what more of that would do for me, but I'm pretty sure I don't want to find out. But I also can't imagine any alternative. Yeah. And then I see my ex-girlfriend who
has nothing
and is happy.
Yeah. Just witnessing someone else's joy and watching someone else derive so much satisfaction from things that you would never have dreamt of doing yourself, right? And realizing that the agency is a lot more important and more powerful than you think. Because a lot of time we do things, perhaps we start off by making a few decisions, and then along the way where we fall into decisions that seem natural because of the ones that we made maybe a couple of years back or 10 years ago or whatever, and then now they seem like natural paths to take, and 30 years later you're like, what the hell?
Once we use our agency, our future ability to use it seems to diminish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about agency a lot. Like how much of what we do is what we want to do versus what people want us to do, or what even what we want to do. You know? Right? Because a lot of the time it's about like, okay, if I take this path, then of course I should do X or Y, Z, whatever, right? But you can't remove the of course part of things. I mean, you could just remove, of course, from that sentence of I'll do this, right? But when you say, of course I'll do this, you know, there's a niggling of doubt there that you've planted, because perhaps you don't want to do it, but you don't admit it. We don't, a lot. Like, I don't admit that I don't want to do some things. And I just say that, you know what, you just got to be an adult. Just do it. But I find that, wow, if that, then 80%, maybe more, right, of our time is actually spent doing shit we don't want to do. It's like, that's a bit bleak.
So yeah. How does this tie into procrastination about writing?
Do you find writing fun? I'm this is a question I'm asking a lot of writers these days. Do you find writing fun?
Half the time.
Okay.
I find it fun. And the other half of the time, it's work. Though I will say, a lot more time that's writing-related time is stressing about the whole fucking thing.
You're right.
I spend way more time worrying about my writing than actually doing the writing.
Yeah, I totally get it. Yeah, constantly trying to, I don't know, figure out sometimes what you want to write, right? Sometimes wondering if this is all a just giant waste of time. Like, you know, because writing doesn't, let's be honest, right? For the amount of stress that, you know, that goes into it, a lot of the thought and the time and the and all of these things, it doesn't actually really pay, you know? Right? If you were worried about money or rent and things like that, right? You wouldn't actually, right, be writing.
Well, it's not a smart choice.
It's not a smart choice. It's a terrible choice. Right? So, and sometimes I think to myself, okay, some of us are lucky enough, right? Lucky enough to not worry so much about the day-to-day that we now have time to torture ourselves by writing, right? Because if you really were, right, in some way, like trying to eke out a, you know, like a day-to-day living, if you were worried about your basic needs and things like that, you wouldn't be writing. You couldn't. There's no way.
Oh, right? No, I worry about those things, and that's why I'm not writing, or not writing nearly as much as I would want to.
Yeah, because it's just not very, right, smart that way.
Well, partly I want to be an author, so I think that writing, so here's the thing. Your book is filled with depressing and depressed people, and the book is not depressing at all. And I think it's because it required a sense of play that you brought to it so that you find humanity in some people, which, if this were like a documentary, this could be a bleak documentary. Look at these poor, miserable emotionally, yeah, dead people, yeah, trying to get excited about otters. Like, that's...
Yeah, yeah.
And you found the humor and the humanity in these characters and built a story, even if it's, you know, kind of a wide open story. There is a story there that you've carefully built something for an audience to enter that brings real pleasure, and brings especially pleasure to me because it has room for my depression and misanthropic outlook where I'm like, people, it's gross.
I think I find life funny and depressing in equal measure. Yeah. And I sometimes find very depressing things extremely funny. Mm-hmm. Because how else will you go on? You know? Right? It's like, yeah, humor, right? So there, but for the grace of laughter, I think. Go a lot of us, yeah. You're right. A lot of things about the novel is extremely depressing. The homelessness.
It's not depressing, but...
The situation.
There's depression, yeah, in the book, yeah, but it's not depressing, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, but I find that it helps me, I guess. You know, like seeing that I can't help it. I'm always laughing at rather bleak things in my own life, I suppose, right? So I guess it just translates into the things that I write as well. So I don't think I'm deliberately funny. I just am like that. I think you explain it better than I do.
Well, It's possible, although this sounds like me trying to put words in your mouth, it's possible that you have a knack for comedy, or you know, an intuitive sense of comedy where you can't plan it. But when you write about a depressing situation, it's like if it's just the right light or just the right wording, it comes off as beautiful rather than just, okay, and now, reader, you must also be depressed. And it makes me feel comforted.
I'm glad.
You know, whereas, I don't know if you've seen the show Friends.
Yes.
But it makes me suicidal.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me why.
Well, it's a show about five or six white people in New York who mostly have boring experiences in New York with other white people. And I'm like, that was never my experience of New York City. And there's something meant to be so comforting about the show. And I'm like, Friends is a show for people without friends, was my joke for a long time. Mm-hmm. And there's something about, I mean, partly humor is subjective. And so when other people find something really funny and you don't, you're like, that's gross. So,
yeah, that's, what was so gross
it could
about
just
friends?
Be that part of it. I just found it difficult to care about anything they had to say. Whereas Seinfeld, even though the characters were like just as superficial as the characters on Friends, but they were more neurotic and they were worse people. But for some reason, like, I really clung to whatever it was they were up to that week.
Oh, I see. So when it comes to comedy, I do quite like Ricky Gervais and his style of, you know, he makes you laugh and cry in the same sentence. It's horrible. It is torturous to watch sometimes because you never know when he's going to hit you. But yeah, I really like stuff by Ricky Gervais. Derek is particularly horrible that way. I love it, right? But it is horrible because in the same episode, you keep bursting into tears five times, but also laughing out loud right after. So it's a mindfuck.
Whatever he's... Well, in The Office, his character, whenever he's talking, I'm like, it's going to turn weird and ugly. And he's not going to have any idea that it's turning weird and ugly because he is weird and ugly. And I think it's a rare example of cringe comedy that I can, like, really absorb. Too often I'm like, no, that's me. I don't want to look directly into the mirror. Like, indirectly is fine.
Try Derek. Have you really watched it? It's set in an old folks' home, a retirement home of some sort. It is extremely bleak, but extremely funny. Mm.
And we'll check it out.
Yes, please.
So there's a big mystery. Why is Jen homeless? And she's cut off all ties to everybody. Which, of course, does make Sookin feel special. He doesn't ever say that, because he wouldn't. But it's like, oh, no, she's willing to let me into her life. And there are these weird intermissions in between chapters that it's difficult to figure out exactly what's going on. And it's suggested she maybe died and is a ghost. But you don't simply dangle the mystery in front of the reader and go, la, la, yeah, I don't have to answer it because nothing matters. And you actually give the reader more to work with instead of just toying with them with the plot. And I'm guessing that's probably something that you spent some pains to come to a decision about, as to how much to reveal and how to reveal it, since the story kind of resists being neat, and yet if it's too unneat, then it's like, what did we get out of the book other than some kind of funny, confusing
stories? Do you find it confusing and difficult in those parts? I've always been quite interested in how people react to that, because everyone reacts to that bit differently.
Well, the intermissions, I didn't lock on so hard that I'm like, this must make sense now, damn it. So that sometimes it seems to, like, really contradict the main story. And so I'm like, it's all right if I don't have it completely figured out. And I still don't completely have it figured out. But in terms of, like, the big mystery, okay, why did she just drop out of society? We have a real answer. And it's satisfying in a book that isn't set up to you know, satisfy the reader at all times. And so that mystery kind of drives the story really forward. And it's rewarding when we get it, but it's also...
not the point. Yeah. In a lot of ways.
It isn't the
point.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, yes, I see what you mean. It started off being quite central, you know, at first. You know, when I first started working on it, it was quite central. I wanted to, you know, it was supposed to be a bigger reveal, you know. But along the way, it stopped being quite as important to me as developing, you know, their friendship, right? The renewal of that friendship between Jin and Sukin and developing, like, you know, him as a person and
rebuilding their relationship, yeah. Even though it's, yeah, is it romantic? No.
No.
It's not completely not, but it's mostly not, but it's a little bit ambiguous.
Yeah. And that was difficult because he is clearly not someone looking for a romantic relationship per se, right? And she's struggling with quite a few things and they're there for each other, but they're not involved in that way.
Well, they're there for each other if they could find each other. She knows where to find him. He doesn't always know where to find her.
He spends a lot of time in that room looking for her. But yeah. So
he's basically stalking her.
He is.
Over a lot of real estate, and then he finds her, and she's like, "Oh, hi!" Like, this is kind of how I planned it, and it's like,
yeah,
the most infuriating thing because
he's planned it, right? He's trying.
She didn't want to be found, and then he found her. She should be bad, but it's like, no, you should have found me. And it's like, how? There's no mechanism. You don't have a pager.
You've got nothing. You've got a bicycle, so you're fast and you move around and
get a bicycle and a backpack. Yeah.
That's it. So, yes, I made things as hard for him as it was possible to make things hard for him, right? So here I, you know, threw him someone from the past.
But if anything was easy for him, I don't think he would go, oh, good.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think he would appreciate it. Yeah. He's used to not being quite, you know. Yeah, that things don't come easy, I suppose. Yeah, so he has to work for stuff. I don't know. But the whole mystery surrounding Jin dropping out of society, it wasn't something that was... I mean, it ended up being quite sidelined, I think. Because I found in the end that it wasn't central anymore. The more I developed the characters, it wasn't something that was so crucial to the plot that it deserves so much reveal or whatever. You know, I had built it up a little and then I just said, it's not that important.
Well, you built it up a lot. But once we find out what it is, it's satisfying. But we also realize it could have been any number of other events as well that could have made her make similar decisions. That the logic that she's using is actually, okay, radical, but profound and like it definitely, if your entire life doesn't make sense,
you stop.
Maybe you need to find a different sense rather than take any old off-the-shelf approach to living your life.
Yeah, and it's very simple, but very few people can or will do it. Right? Just stop what you're doing and do something else. Right? Very often. Right? And that's an easy fix, but not easy.
I'm trying to remember the Taoist poet who like is really, really trying to be a good Taoist. And it's like, but I like having friends. Which complicates everything else I would do, just be a Taoist, like living the simplest, most natural life. It's like, but I want friends.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to give up everything. And, you know, and even small changes in our lives are difficult. Right, so I mean, that's what Sukin struggles with. Any small change to him is unwelcome. But she's done this really radical thing, and she doesn't think it's that radical. She's just doing it. But he can't cope with tiny changes in anything most of the time.
Well, she's forced to live in the moment.
Oh, when you're living out of a suitcase, quite, you know? Yeah.
But psychologically, also, she's not in control of what she pays attention to.
Mm.
Which makes her approach to everyday life like really important.
Yeah, and not the kind of thing that we think about. The rest of us, right, who don't live that way, don't think of it like that. So that's why everything that she does seems a little odd. But it's not odd if you don't know exactly where your next meal is going to come from, or exactly where you're going to sleep, you know, or if someone's going to come after you in the next hour, or, right? And who, what you're going to do today to make sure you're alive for the next day. But it's about, I think, just him figuring out, and I think myself as well, figuring out how different, I think, perspectives can be.
And there are people who can wing it for their life and it works out and you're like, that's not fair.
Every time I try to wing it, yeah, I fuck up. So
you're just going
to
hang out and people are going to take care of you. You'll have some food and water and you might get a shower every couple of days. Like,
yeah,
that's going to work out.
This is why I've always envied cats, because cats get all of that. You're a cat, someone takes care of you, someone feeds you. You don't have to give them a lot of affection. You know, cat people generally have accepted that cats aren't affectionate. And then you can be at least like being an otter, but even easier, because you know someone comes along, opens a can of cat food, and gives you stuff. It's great. I think about that a lot.
Yeah, dogs are a lot of work. My brother has 4 dogs in his family.
That's nuts. Why?
That's a doghouse.
Yeah. It's overrun. I mean, it would be. I mean, every moment of the day is like feeding the dog, walking the dog, spending time with the dogs, right? No?
Well, the feeding and the walking, like, okay, that's finite. It's more time than I want to spend, but it's finite. But yeah, 4 emotionally needy dogs.
Yeah, dogs are very demanding, I feel. But some people like that. Some people do like the fact that dogs love you.
And the cat loves me, but maybe a half an hour every day.
Yeah, if it feels like it. If it wants to love you. It's not about how much love you need from the cat.
Well, there's this whole power trip thing where I try to ignore him, he tries to ignore me, and eventually he's like, oh, no, I do want some attention. Okay. Whereas if I'm like, let me give you attention, he's like, hey, hey, hey.
I thought this was casual, John.
It's like, you're allowed to give me my stink meat, but the touchy-touchy, yeah, I don't know.
You ask before you do this, right? Yeah, yeah. I don't particularly want a pet right now. I wish you had asked. But yeah, I envy cats a lot. Yeah.
Jack got along with cats. There's photos of him out there hanging on to cats with oranges around.
Right. I see. Smart man.
He knew his people. Alcoholics, baseball players, jazz musicians, and cats. Those were his.
Yeah, so it sounds like a good mix.
So I love the ending of the book, and I feel like it's just ambiguous enough. So it's like, okay, we're not going to sew it up like too neatly, but also the things in the book have changed our hero enough so that, yeah, things are going to be different. And I feel like it would just be, like, whatever happens next, it's probably going to be zany and fun, but also maybe isn't a book.
Yeah, his story obviously will continue and on his own terms and whatever, but I think, yeah, I just didn't want to tell... I also didn't want to think about it too much. I felt that, you know, there's a limit to that, like how much further we can, you know, that I wanted to really push it after, right? We got a little of what we want. He's changed as much as someone can be expected to change without being too radical about it. And then after that, you know, we leave him on his own and he takes his own journey and we're done.
Well, I love the balance of telling a real story with this much chaos in it.
Oh, yeah.
And like,
thank you.
It takes talent and patience, I think, or just maybe an awful lot of luck, but somehow to make all of that kind of work. You know, if a novel's too chaotic, then it's like, I don't know what just happened. Like, there were a lot of words. But books like that aren't page turners. You know, like, this is one of those great novels where every time I get back into reading, it's like, all right, nobody better fuck with me for the next 20 minutes, because, like, I need to get through at least 2 more chapters because I'm really enjoying this.
I'm glad you did.
And I want to say it almost felt effortless. It's not effortless because I'm remembering things, and like, part of the fun of the story is like you're trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, it's not easy to read.
And so it is and it is. It is, but as long as you're okay with a certain amount of ambiguity. Mm. And it's not so much ambiguity because, and this is something I wrestle with so much. You know, I teach straightforward storytelling, and there's also, like, I love anarchy, but not left to its own complete devices because that ends up being boring. And so, you know, for me, it always is this balance, you know, this Apollonian Dionysian combination of, okay, it's got to be kind of crazy, but it has to make enough sense for it to be worth the journey.
A lot of it, I think, comes from just, I didn't know what was going to happen sometimes. I just, yeah. So sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't, right? And then as I wrote it, then things just happened. So I don't know whether I want to say, like, you know, maybe it's my muse that you particularly enjoy, you know, in that sense that sometimes it just comes and sometimes it does, it just works.
Well, I think, yeah, maybe it comes back to, okay, yeah, is it fun when I write or is it miserable when I write? And the more fun it is, normally also the more readable it's going to be for my audience if what I'm writing I'm kind of enjoying. And yeah, if I have it all figured out, then it's a dead thing.
Yeah, exactly.
If I have nothing figured out, well, then it's a car wreck. And it's like, okay, that's not wildly better.
I guess it's like, I mean, you're trying to entertain yourself first. You know, when you're writing a novel or whatever.
But not too much. Or at least, if I'm laughing too much, I'm like, oh, this is... No one else can actually.
I always think to myself, okay, if I'm not even entertaining me, this must be a waste of time. It starts off bad, right? If I can't entertain me, for God's sake, what is this, right? So that's how I always see things. I start off with trying to entertain myself because I find that a lot of the time we're not reading for wisdom. Right, we're not reading for wisdom. We're not reading to, you know, particularly understand perspectives of other writers or whatever.
I think we are, but I don't think we want it first.
Yeah, we read a lot to be entertained.
And frankly, yeah, if a book entertains me and doesn't give me any wisdom, I'm like, that was pretty good. That was solid.
Exactly. Yeah.
Write another one. I'll read it.
Yeah. So entertain
if it
me
could
first.
Do that and kind of feed me and make me feel like I'm less insane than I feel, then that's, you know, like, to me, that's the literature I want to read, is not just literature that's good for you, but literature that is fun and...
It fills time in a way that we feel we're spending the time doing something for ourselves as well, right? It's not, you're not reading it for the writer, you're reading it for yourself, right? You're hoping to derive some pleasure out of it. Maybe you learn something, maybe you don't, right? But generally, if you're not entertained, it's a bad way to spend time if you're reading a novel, right? I mean, if you're reading in something else, it's like your nonfiction or whatever it is, please, you know, that doesn't apply. But if you're reading a novel, you have to be entertained.
Well, let's talk about Sukin's taste in literature, because from what I can see, he's deeply bored with his professional life, and he keeps bringing shocking things into the classroom to shock his students, and then he wants them to explain why they're shocked. And, all right, I've probably done that once or twice.
Did you use the same stuff?
Not poetry, though, frankly, the poems that he picked out, yeah, no, they're a lot of bang for the buck there. Like, no, but I've assigned things where, all right, part of the problem is when I taught stuff like that, I forgot what's in them. And I forget, oh, I like kind of raw, nasty stuff in my literature sometimes. And then I would assign a book and I'm like, oh, I didn't remember that my students would be reading quite so much about fellatio. I wouldn't have planned that. Note to self, like, okay, maybe I love this book so much, but maybe just recommend it to students who are interested in the bigger themes rather than...
Then have it...
A
required reading.
So nobody complained, because I think the books were pretty great, but it is a problem I've had over the years is, yeah, my taste can be shocking, and I just forget that other people are really shocked. Two different friend groups, and I think like there was like 5 years difference, and I just keep forgetting. I'm like... Oh, right. At the beginning of Tetsuo the Iron Man, a dominatrix shoves a vacuum cleaner attachment up a guy's butt. And I'm like, and that's in the first, like, 3 minutes? And I keep forgetting. I forgot, like, twice. And so it's like, you can no longer pick any movies that we watch, John, forever. And I'm like, okay.
Probably fair.
Yeah. We should have built up to that rather than just... Oh. I still stand by that movie, but yeah. It's probably a bad sign that I just forget that stuff like that is in the movie. I mean, that's how it starts.
I think that because you're consuming so much literature of different kinds and that kind of thing, it's easy to forget things that are shocking, but maybe generally not so material to the storyline.
I think it's that I...
Oh, you're not shocked?
I like things that are shocking, but then I forget how shocking they are. Part of me thinks Sookin maybe wants to get fired by bringing these things into the classroom, and then he could claim that he's a martyr or something. And I don't think he wants to do anything else necessarily throughout most of the book.
Yeah, he's just bored. So he just feels the need to constantly entertain himself in this very small ways, but also it's a protest, right? It's a protest against, you know, like what he's having to do. I have to teach. I have to do, you know, teach within these confines. Whenever I can get away with, you know, a little bit of shocking stuff here and there.
And there's also the sense that whatever happens in a classroom is dead, that we are dissecting a dead thing. And when you shock students and you go, all right, so what's exciting about this, guys? Like, let's get into... It does hopefully spark a more interesting conversation than tell me about the themes in this poem and I'm going to go slit my wrist in the other room.
Exactly. And I think when you're a teacher, and you're a teacher, right? And I tutored for years. Sometimes what makes better sense when you're trying to get people to learn something is... the structure.
You lean on the things that are teachable.
Yeah,
or,
right? Yeah. But sometimes you just can't because that structure is so boring. Right? You know? Right? The five parts.
That's a sonnet. All right. Haiku. Everyone, get your fingers out. We're going to start counting. It's like, oh, this is a bummer.
Exactly. So as teachers, that's the constant struggle. Like on one hand, right, you understand that the pedagogical structure is there. There is something that needs to be structured, that needs to be done in a particular way. But at the same time, if you've been doing it for like 10 years, surely, right? And you've seen these boring children be bored, right? Mm-hmm. For 10 years, right? I don't know. Just changing it up. Again, entertaining yourself. There are a lot of things I think we do for entertainment. In like small doses every day.
Well, and the teaching materials are sometimes so contradictory to the actual literary experience. One favor my high school senior English teacher did was point out some of the dirty jokes in Hamlet.
Ah, of course.
Which I really latched onto hard. Like, okay, so we don't have to talk about Aristotle, but we can talk about, like, why Hamlet is so nasty. Just for a couple minutes, but all right. I'm like, this play might be more interesting than I thought.
How old were you at this point in time?
17, 18?
Mm. Yeah, I did Hamlet at the same age. It was a very tiresome play, I felt. When I was younger, at 17, it is a very tiresome play. But when I was older and I reread it, it was great. But at 17, it was such a chore. Mm-hmm. Trying, right? Getting through everything, trying, memorizing quotes, figuring out, like, right? Who was doing what kind of...
It's also mostly a play in which nothing happens. Mm-hmm. Like, everything happens at the end.
Exactly.
And there's one other event.
Yeah, and that's it.
With a lot of moaning and groaning and complaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's
mostly complaining. And a lot of time lapses for no reason. But yeah, anyway, things like that.
Well, okay, so to anyone who really wants to know what Hamlet's about and why it's structured the way it is, like, following the structure is like, all right, like, okay, yeah, here's the skeleton of the dead thing. But if we want to ask, why is Hamlet a play in which almost nothing happens until the end, here's the explanation. and it comes from a book called The Hamlet Problem and Its Solution, and I forget the author's name. Emerson Venable, I think, is the name. Yeah. But Hamlet wants to kill his uncle before he knows anything is wrong. And when his dad's ghost says, "You have to kill him because he killed me," Hamlet doesn't trust the information because he knows killing is wrong, and he really just wanted to kill him just because he was having sex with his mom. Like, just that was enough.
Yeah.
And so Hamlet is over and over again trying to prove to himself that his uncle is in fact guilty of a certain form of incest. Yeah. So that's why the play takes forever.
And what's the solution? I mean,
that's the solution.
They're making it such that there were so many time lapses. And what about the strange soliloquies that went nowhere?
Hamlet is dragging his feet because... So when he actually commits the murders at the end, or the vengeance at the end, no, he actually is kind of angry and nasty when he kills his uncle Claudius. But we do see when he kills Laertes, he has regret and he's not glad that Laertes is dying. And so what we do see is he arrives at a mental state where he's not just like, "I want to fucking kill that guy." He's like, okay, it's kind of like Suken going through life. He's like, it's out of my control. Like, I just have to be ready.
I have to kill him now because he wants to kill me.
So. I don't want to be killed standing around looking in the other direction. So that's all I need to do is just make sure I'm looking in the right direction so that when the time comes, I will kill my uncle if I have to. But much of the play is about him wrestling with his conscience because he wants to kill him too much. And also, he probably hasn't killed anybody before. And so...
Big decision.
The first time, not that I have any experience with that. Whereas, I saw Romeo and Juliet, a matinee here at Orlando Shakespeare Theater, with an audience full of high school students. And they did a semi-period appropriate piece. They had some pop music from today, but mostly it was like Elizabethan. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, watching the play, like all the students got it and they were so excited. And as a jaded aging guy, I'm like, oh, this was the perfect audience to see this with. If I saw it with grown-ups, it'd be like, oh yes, the themes are... And the kids are like, holy shit, that's me. They're like, wow, this Will guy is better than I thought.
Well, that's nice. Right? Romeo and Juliet is just one of those things. Because a lot of it is in the action, right? You know, the balcony. It's all very dramatic. All that running away, the poison.
A lot of the jokes, you have to hear them for them to be funny.
I've never seen it performed, but I guess I saw the Baz Luhrmann film. So,
There, I don't think the actors knew what they were saying most of the time. There were two actors who were ringers who knew what they were saying all the time, but they weren't at the center of the movie. The guy who played the priest and the guy who played the prince, like those were the ringers, and everyone else, even Paul Sorvino, who I adore, looked like he didn't quite know what he was doing.
I can't remember it much.
It's kind of like a fever dream. That's what his movies tend to be like.
I think part of it was, for the novel was, the struggle of having to teach something as heavy as Shakespeare to teenagers.
And the comedies are a little too dirty.
Something as heavy as Hamlet, or very little comedy, right? A lot of the themes are quite gruesome, right? Mm-hmm. Things that you don't expect anyone at the age of 17, and he's teaching 17-year-olds, right? To empathize with, right? So it is sort of everything that's being done in that classroom is in vain. It's
to do the official scholarly program requires denuding the literature of its life.
Because a lot of it's quite horrible, right? But how do you talk to a 17-year-old about that level of rage or like all wanting to murder your uncle, really.
They probably know that, but
yeah.
If you're Sukin, who struggles to talk to anybody. And also, yeah, the problem... So I've only taught college. I've never taught high school. And so if you're like, okay, who here has felt homicidal rage in high school? It's like, okay, where does that conversation go next? Exactly. In college, I can steer it into a positive place. But in high school, it's like, oh, yeah, no, I'm ready to kill my stepdad right now. It's like, I have a plan. Like, all right, let's hit pause.
It's a ludicrous situation, right? Trying to get students of that age to appreciate Shakespeare, right? Oh, Hamlet in particular.
It could be a real struggle in college, yeah.
Right? And then being himself already so nearly a sociopath, right? And then having to struggle with the ludicrousness of teaching Hamlet to teenagers and then that being your life for 8 hours.
And if you love literature... You're killing it every day.
Exactly.
In front of a bored audience.
They don't care.
That almost guarantees that literature is going to be a little bit more dead in the future.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Every year,
fewer
people are going to like literature because it is destroyed right there.
By people who love it.
By people who love it and don't have an adequate plan to... convey that love.
Yeah. And you're working within a system that doesn't particularly understand, right, how to cultivate a love of literature, because you can't, there's no system for cultivating a love of literature.
It's tough. It certainly is tough. So when I've taught like intro to lit classes in college, my scheme was to tell everyone, first of all, you're allowed to not like any particular thing I've asked you to read. You have permission. You have my blessing to say, I don't like this. Which I think frees them up then to like, okay. Because if you're told, you have to like all of this. This is important. This is capital Canonical. L literature. Yeah, this is the canon. Then they're like, fuck this. I don't... I have agency. And the only way they can enact that agency is to not like it. Yeah. And if they're struggling to understand it and they don't want to read it in the first place. So I'm like, you don't have to like any of it. Though I'll be shocked if you... don't find at least one or two pieces you really like. And then I assign like a wide variety of things on a wide variety of subjects. And then I've got like bro dudes who are like, oh my God, Elizabeth Bishop wrote about fishing and it's beautiful. And I'm like, gotcha. It's like, yep, that poem written by a woman. And you love a poem about fishing.
It's surprising what we end up liking and what we don't. Yeah.
But even then, there are days when it's like, okay, so out of 20 people, 4 liked what I brought in today. Okay. It's better than nothing.
I'm surprised anyone likes James Joyce. Someone wants, a whole bunch of people want to kill me right now. But I don't get it. I wrote my
master's thesis on James Joyce.
You see? I read Ulysses so unwillingly. And
It's tougher than Shakespeare. It's actually tougher than Shakespeare.
It is. And it was tiring. This is tiring. But anyway.
Well, and unlike you, like he was deliberately challenging his audience. And anytime you recognized a pattern, you're like, okay, wait, no, I think I understand this chapter. The next chapter, okay, throw out all those old rules. You're reading a completely different book now. And you're like, ah.
He
was deliberately writing
like
the most difficult book that was possible, and the most irritating thing about it is probably, I don't know if he's obfuscating so much as just really, really complicating. Like, if you study it enough, like, every piece is carefully placed. It's not simply, oh, let's just make it kind of gobbledygook and you can't understand. Like, no. Like, if you study it hard enough...
You have.
You can figure... no, not all of it. No. There's like 3 corners of Ulysses. I'm like, okay, yeah, I got those. The other 24, I don't know so much. But it's a real challenge, and I don't think I've spent much time as a teacher like introducing Joyce to people. I'm like, read it if you want to, but I've got my own peculiar relationship with it.
Yeah, it's tough. I will never forget having to read it as a second year student at some point. Yeah. And then going, can I get away with not?
Yeah. Kind of.
Yeah.
If you get the Stuart Gilbert book.
Well, see, no
Joyce was smart enough to know how difficult it was. And so when that came out, and then later when the next book, Finnegan's Wake, came out, there were kind of scholarly treatises that came out at the same time, so that when you go, what the hell is going on?
You had a guidebook.
Oh, yeah, here is the guidebook, also for sale at the bookstore.
Maybe he was just really commercially very astute.
No, because he was kind of a poor lunatic, but I think he did understand enough about that rhetorical situation to give his book, you know, the proper launch so that it had a chance. And so all the smart people are like, oh, we got to figure this out now.
Without reading the guidebook, I suppose.
Well, without admitting you read the guidebook. Mm. Yeah, no, but the guidebook, actually pretty helpful. So if you read the guidebook, which is readable, then you could pretend to understand Ulysses. Okay. And I don't object to anybody doing that, because it's a beautiful, crazy book and fun in places, but it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So how's your time in the house been?
It's been good, I think. I'm trying to finish up my second novel. I started working on it in 2019. And then sometime during the pandemic, I just stopped, like during the lockdowns and everything. And I always thought that I was the kind of writer who, if you shut away in a cave, would be fine. But I'm not. So I always thought that if you give me enough time, shut me in a cave and that kind of thing. And that's basically what a lockdown is, right? You get stuck at home.
A year later, I come out with a book.
Yeah. But no, that didn't happen at all. I sat at home. In Singapore, we had quite a few months where we weren't allowed to visit anyone. And we weren't allowed to have visitors. If you lived alone, it was just, that was it. You know, and I live alone. So I got used to basically just sitting around every day, and I wasn't employed at the time. So I sat around every day and ate chips and watched, you know, stuff on Netflix, really. And that was, and it was a productive day. If I didn't finish.
Was that satisfying?
Yeah. Vaguely. But I didn't get any, after like maybe a month, I stopped being able to write. And my time here at the house has been great, because it's allowed me to pick up that novel, reread it, try and think about, you know, where I was going at the time, because I can't remember. So now it's a different novel from what I guess it was meant to be when I started.
Books will do that.
Mm, right, they'll take their own life, right?
I'm a firm believer of having a plan and then being a little bit loose when you actually enact that plan.
So I did have something of a plan, but when I looked at it this year, it didn't seem like right. It didn't seem right anymore.
Well, also there's that bit where your memory is like, okay, so this book, like, it was awesome and it was great. And then you go back and look at it and you're like, it's all right. And partly it's because it's just, you're outside of that moment of creation. And it maybe doesn't seem as lively. I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't speak for you. But sometimes that happens to me, where I go back to an old project and I'm like, it's all right. It's not necessarily as good as my best stuff. Maybe it'll get there.
Yeah. For me, it was more like when I reread it, there were some bits when I'm like, okay, was I going to do something with this? You know, but what did I want to do with this? So a lot of it was that you're actually pretty much like, halfway through, I think, you know, and then not knowing exactly what the hell I was doing with some of this stuff, right?
Well, and the role of intuition, and that part of you that doesn't know what you're doing because you want to be surprised, and then you pick it up a year later and you're like,
what's that?
Oh, right, that feeling I had about what I might be doing, but it wasn't really a thought. I don't have that feeling anymore, so what goes there now?
Yeah. Spend like the last month, I guess, you know, getting reacquainted, right, with the novel. And I guess in a weird way, being reacquainted with what my mind was like in late 2019, early 2020, because that clearly shaped a lot of what went into that, you know, that novel at the time. So just building on that, and then, you know, trying to hopefully wrap it up this month before I head back. It's longer than this one. It's going to be a lot longer. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it is a fact.
That is the show for this week. I would like to thank Yo Joanne, Samantha Nickerson for editing this episode, and of course, our sponsor, Scribophile. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including superior advice from Dr. Perfect, comic book reviews from Drew Barth, and film reviews from Jeff Schuster, who is the curator of schlock. All right, gang, until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Dear listeners, this is your friend, Chris Booth. If you have enjoyed this program, which comes to you absolutely free, and are wondering what you might do to support this show, please, please, please write a review of the podcast on iTunes, comment on the website, and most of all, tell your friends. If you buy books online, please click on the Powell's link on the left-hand side of the website. Doing so will grant this show a small commission on anything you purchase, at no expense at all to you, and help support both a wonderful podcast and a wonderful brick-and-mortar independent bookstore in Portland, Oregon. If you must use the services of the metastasizing mega-corporate empire Amazon.com, then there is a similar link to Amazon further down the page on the left-hand side. You fiends. Thank you for listening. I will now resume drinking. Ever yours, Christopher.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.